watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WELS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXE Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. There's a spirit of rebellion rising throughout America against the domination of our society by corporate interests and values. Though it receives little to no media coverage, a growing number of people within what has traditionally been the mainstream of society are noticing the erosion of democratic structures and values that are the result of this corporate incursion. They are members of the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association, fighting high-stakes testing in Massachusetts public schools. They are family farmers fighting for their existence against the domination of U.S. agriculture by biotech companies. They are all developing a deep understanding of the systemic problems, and they are organizing resistance nationally and internationally. Tonight, we're going to hear from them.
Be riding my shiny black vest. No fat rich man's pony can ever overtake you. There's not a rider from the east to the west to hold you alive in this darkness and midnight. When the pot bell
Massachusetts is one of the states which has instituted what is called high-stakes standardized testing in public high schools. This test, known there as the MCAS, the MCAS, would effectively create a growing number of school dropouts who can't hope to aspire to any sort of a life beyond dead-end jobs. These tests are part of the corporate attack on the democratic underpinnings of the public education system, not an attempt to improve the quality of education as its backers in business and government claim. So says a former director of the Parent Teachers Association, David Stratman. Scott Gurian spoke with Stratman in Boston a few months ago.
Beginning this May, all 10th graders attending public schools in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will be required to pass the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System test in order to graduate. But what does this test mean, and what effects does high-stake testing have on children? Dr. David Stratman is an educational consultant and former Washington director of the National Parent Teacher Association, and he says there's much reason for concern.
MCAS stands for the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System. It's a test, a so-called high-stakes test, which is imposed on kids in the 4th, 8th, and 10th grades for public school children in Massachusetts. We call it high-stakes because beginning in this May of 2001, if 10th graders do not pass that test, then they will not receive a high school diploma. And the reason I call the talk, why are we doing this to our children? I believe that the MCAS test is very destructive. I think it's designed to cause lots of kids to fail. It tests children on above their grade level. For example, the fourth grade reading test tests kids at a seventh grade level. So lots of children, 40% of the kids around the state, fail on this. The question to me that's so important is, why would such a destructive test be imposed on young people? And I think the answer to that is that the people who are behind MCAS are the most powerful corporate forces in our state and in the country: the Federal Reserve Bank, the Massachusetts Business Roundtable, Intel, IBM, Fleet Bank, and other corporate forces who, I believe, have the goal of causing many young people to drop out of school in creating lowering the expectations of many, many kids so that they will fit into their place in a society that's becoming more unequal and less democratic.
Can you maybe give a little bit of a background of what the history is that's leading up to this present situation we're in with MCAS?
Well, MCAS is part of the 1993 Education Reform Act in Massachusetts. But similar states have been, or pardon me, similar tests have been imposed in 27 states, and similar education reform has happened in 49 states. The background of corporate-led education reform, I think, is it goes back to the late 70s, and such things as the Tuition Tax Credit Act and other measures intended to privatize public education and disequalize educational resources, further disequalize education in the United States. This intensified in the 1980s with such measures as the A Nation at Risk report and legislation that was undertaken in many different states to further disequalize educational opportunity.
Over the past few years, we've seen the privatization of formerly public social services, most recently prisons, and now public schools. Many have viewed this latest trend, you know, this last trend especially of schools as especially troublesome. What are, maybe you could voice some of their concerns and explain how MCAS fits into that picture.
Yes, the public education system in the United States, for all its faults, I think it's been really at the center of democratic life in our country. And the public schools of any given town have been the principal focus of people's discussion of a common good and discussion of the future of our children. Now, privatization is a direct attack on the notion of a common good. Instead of people coming together to figure out how to make things better for our kids. Instead, privatization substitutes for that competition of individual parents to get their kid into the right school, competition to see that my kid is the best or does the best or gets the most opportunity. This is very destructive of democracy, I think. It's very destructive of any glimmer of equality in our society. And I think it really weakens people's ability to control their lives, because if we're all fighting to see who's going to get what, then the truly powerful forces in our society, the corporate forces, have that much more control. MCAS, I think, is designed, MCAS and the other corporate education reforms, like merit pay for teachers or the end of tenure for teachers or school-to-work programs or privatization itself. I think that all of these reforms are intended to intensify what was already the problem with the public school system. That is, it intensifies competition and stratification. I think that the public school system does need substantial reform, but the reform should go in the opposite direction. The reform should go towards greater cooperation to see that our children succeed and greater equality in the public schools.
David Stratman, you're the former head of the Washington head of the National Parent Teachers Association, so you're familiar with educational institutions across the country. I know you mentioned briefly that there are parallels to MCAS across the country and also around the world.
Yes, 27 states already have imposed a high-stakes test similar to MCAS. 49 of the 50 states have corporate designed education reform programs, including high standards and other elements that I think are destructive. And I mentioned today that I was speaking at a conference in Mexico a couple of years ago, and I was astonished to hear speeches from heads of teacher unions from eight different countries, and each of them described precisely the same things happening in their own countries. That is, education reform that consisted, number one, of privatization of public education, number two, the imposition of high-stakes tests, and number three, the changing of traditional education into job training, school to work.
Could you speak about your experience with the Minnesota Business Partnership and how that relates to MCAS?
Yes, I work as an educational consultant And I was hired in 1985 by the Minnesota Education Association to design a long-range plan for the union, but also to help it defeat the Minnesota Business Partnership Education Reform Plan. Now, the Business Partnership Reform Plan was the most sophisticated education reform plan at the time, and it had a number of different destructive elements. But the principal one, or the key to it, was that it would have changed the K through 12, the kindergarten through 12th grade education system, into a K through 10 system, so that at the end of the 10th grade, all the students would leave school with a certificate of completion, I believe it was called, and then the top 20% would have been invited back to complete their education and get a high school diploma. Now, the business partner, and incidentally, Minnesota at the time had the highest school completion rate in the country, so 91% of Minnesota young people completed 12th grade, completed high school, and a high proportion went on to further education. So the Minnesota Business Partnership said that the goal of its reform plan was to give young people more personal flexibility. And we said, no, that's not the real goal. The goal is to drive tens of thousands of young people out of high school without a diploma, so that the only jobs they can get is flipping hamburgers or working in the stockyards. We were able to defeat that plan because it was so outrageous. But I think that MCAS and the high-stakes tests, which exist in these other states and here, are designed to accomplish the same thing as that K through 10 program was. That is to say, they're designed to drive a huge proportion of kids out of school in the 10th grade, to increase the pool of cheap labor, to lower these young people's expectations, and to force everyone to toe the line and to accept their role in a society that's becoming more unequal and less democratic. Very shortly, New Democracy is going to be in a position to call for a program that we're calling mass refusal, as we're encouraging a mass refusal by teacher union locals to administer the test, mass refusal by parents to allow their children to take the test, and mass refusal by 10th grade students to take the test themselves.
So there's certainly a lot of opposition to MCAS, but on the other hand, who specifically is in support of MCAS? Who, specific corporations or individuals?
Well, the most powerful organized force promoting MCAS, aside from the Department of Education and education officials in the state legislature, is an organization called Mass Insight. Mass Insight consists of the Massachusetts Business Roundtable, the Massachusetts Board of Real Estate, and many of the most powerful corporations in the state and in the country. I believe I already mentioned the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston is co-chair of Mass Insight. Boston Edison, Fleet Bank, Intel, IBM, State Street Bank, many other large corporations are part of Mass Insight. The Boston Globe has been probably the most vigorous promoter of MCAS in the state. And I think it's important to realize that, because some people have said, well, this is just a right-wing problem or something like that, or it's not true at all. These corporations that I mentioned are right at the center of our society, the most powerful. And the Boston Globe is the most liberal newspaper in the nation, and they are the most vigorous supporters of MCAS.
And how do those corporations and banks profit from MCAS?
I don't believe that they profit from MCAS. I believe that MCAS assists them in the long-term goal of social control, because what MCAS does is it says to a whole generation of people that we have standards, we have erected standards which you have to meet. And it tells, so far, 40% of our kids who have taken MCAS have failed it. It says that you don't make the grade. So I think MCAS has to be understood in its social context. And its social context is a society that has become increasingly unequal in the last 25 years. I think the background of MCAS and of education reform generally is that in the 1960s, there was in the United States and around the world, there was a tremendous revolutionary upsurge. We know in the States, for example, there was a powerful movement against the Vietnam War. There was a powerful civil rights movement, a powerful movement for social equality of men and women, of black and white, a very powerful rank-and-file labor movement. And in other countries, France, 10 million workers occupied their factories. Czechoslovakia, ordinary people fought Soviet tanks in the streets. There was a revolutionary upsurge around the world, and the leaders of, the corporate and political leaders decided that the best way to deal with a revolution of rising expectations was to try to lower people's expectations. In 1972, the CEOs of the 200 largest corporations in the country met for a week in Washington, D.C., and they formed the Business Roundtable with the express purpose of going on the counteroffensive against labor and against all these social movements. I think that the social policies and economic policies that we have endured for the last 25 years, for example, the shipping of so many jobs overseas, laws like NAFTA, the computerization of work, the slashing of social programs or slashing of unemployment or food stamps or welfare reform, all these things are designed, I think, to make people feel more insecure, make them feel more vulnerable, and make them more subject to social control, to top-down, undemocratic control, and that's what MCAS is part of.
So what, in your opinion, should be the goal of education?
Well, I think that education is basically going to be for one of two goals. I think our choices come down to two. One choice is to prepare kids to fit the needs of the corporations, to fit into a world under which they have no control. That's the way our education, or that's the goal, I think, of the powerful people trying to affect education policy now. The alternative, I believe, is what I call education for democracy. That is, to encourage our young people to understand their world and to change it. And that's the direction I think education reform should be going.
And what is, in your opinion, the answer to MCAS?
Well, I think that MCAS, the immediate answer to MCAS is we have to stop MCAS and we have to change the schools. We have to change the schools in a direction of greater equality, greater cooperation, greater support for teachers and kids to succeed at the work of education. The larger answer to MCAS, I think, is this. MCAS is really a kind of window into our society. And if you look through that window, I think you can see that on one side of our society, there's very, very powerful people, the corporations and political leaders and the masters of great wealth. And they value competition and inequality and control from above. And on the other hand, other side of that conflict, I think, stand most people, ordinary people, who believe in support for each other, they believe in commitment to each other, they believe in equality and control from below. New Democracy, the organization of which I'm part, is trying to build a revolutionary movement that says that we have to win this battle for the direction of our society. We have to transform our society to make it fulfill the vision of what human society and what democracy could be like.
Dr. David Stratman is the former Washington director of the National Parent Teachers Association and the founder of an organization called New Democracy. He was interviewed Sunday, February 11th, at the Community Church of Boston. For more info on MCAS and New Democracy, call David Stratman at 617-524-4073. That's 617-524-4073, or visit the New Democracy webpage on the internet at www.newdemocracyworld.org. Reporting from Boston, this is Scott Gurian.
Jonathan King is a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology who became interested in the ramifications of high-stakes testing because his children attend Massachusetts public schools. Krister reports on King's analysis of the connection between such tests and larger corporate schemes, such as the free trade area of the Americas.
There has been considerable public attention focused on the negative impact the MCAS tests have on school curricula, teachers, and students, especially on working-class students, students of color, and students whose native language is not English. But less attention has been paid to the connections between corporations and Massachusetts' new system of testing. While we might wonder how the MCAS could be connected with the free trade area of the Americas, Jonathan King demonstrated that no conspiracy theories are required to see how corporations benefit, both locally and on a global scale, from the nationwide trend toward high-stakes standardized testing in the public schools. King outlined three components to the corporate origins of the MCAS. First, pro-corporate think tanks have gained a central role in shaping educational policy in Massachusetts since the early 90s, when the legislation underwriting the MCAS was passed.
1993 in Massachusetts, as in many places in the country, public schools were financed by local property tax. That's an enormous inequity between a New Bedford and a Wellesley or a Weston and Bill Ricker in terms of how much they could raise in property tax. There were parent groups who sued for many years, and finally there was this 1993 Education Reform Act, very important, which provided state funds to even out spending for education. So now all communities get, in addition to the local property tax, they get an assessment from the state income tax. It's varying amounts, but in some communities it's very, very substantial. It also called for the creation of a framework of common knowledge for all Massachusetts students, and it called for establishing a comprehensive system for assessing school and student progress. And the language of the bill is very clear. It says multi-component to deal with the fact that kids have different talents, they have different backgrounds, etc. All right. Everybody in this room remembers the election in which Weld ran against Silver. Weld won. But Weld makes Silver the chair of the Massachusetts Board of Education, his Democratic opponent. Right? Beautiful example of, we say in the Labor Party, right, the bosses have two parties, the workers need one. All right, so these guys unite. Very, very powerful alliance. And most of you have heard of Horace Mann. You know Massachusetts sits high in the pantheon of public education in the United States. And it was in Massachusetts where the first establishment of the State Board of Education that was going to look at these things. And it had a long tradition of being a highly respected group, lay leaders and education leaders. And it was constructed so that the sitting governor could neither fire or appoint all the members to insulate it from the political changes. So these guys slipped through the Democratic-controlled legislature a bill which changed the law around who the Board of Education was, and allowed the sitting governor to appoint a smaller 9-member Board of Education. So Weld and Silver appointed a 9-member Board of Education. None of these people have any association with public education, teachers or educators. 5 of them were associated with these national right-wing think tanks, the Manhattan Institute, Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute, and then the Massachusetts one, the Pioneer Institute.
A second component of the corporate interests underlying the MCAS has been the support it has gained through such corporate-funded organizations as Mass Insight, a nonprofit group funded by Fleet Bank, Travelers Insurance, Raytheon, and other leading Massachusetts corporations. King explained that these corporations have an interest in cultivating mechanisms for controlling curricula and for tailoring the amount of public money spent on education to corporate needs. The MCAS provides such mechanisms. For example, as corporations shift high-tech jobs abroad in search of lower wages, they are less willing to shoulder the tax burden required to support public higher education. If low scores on the MCAS constitute grounds for barring students from admission to the UMass system, as has been proposed, then the MCAS could function to justify reducing public financial support for higher ed in Massachusetts. A third corporate connection with the MCAS is in the growth of the corporate education sector itself.
Public education is the largest sector in the United States economy that's not yet privatized. Right? It used to be there were 3 sectors, prisons, hospitals, and education. prisons have been privatized, hospitals have been privatized, but K-12 education is the last bastion. It's 10% of the gross domestic product, but 0.1% of the stock market, something like that. So there's a corporate wing, and I'll give you some of the names in a minute, who's spotted this, that there's this big public sector waiting to be privatized. K-12, right, kindergarten through high school. And a number of companies have formed. The ones that operate in Massachusetts are Advantage Schools, Inc., Beacon Management Corporation, some that you would know of, Edison, the Edison company you know of because that's national, Michael Milken, Knowledge University, and then Weld is on the board of a big one that has a name, is one of those, somebody Equity Partners. Their business, if you read their literature they put out to investors, is to privatize public schools.
King explained how charter schools provide a key mechanism through which the new educational corporations can profit from K-12 public schooling. The private companies are contracted to operate public schools at a profit, but at public expense. Meanwhile, the negative publicity about the public schools generated by the MCAS functions to encourage parents to enroll their children at charter schools. Finally, King drew central connections between multinational trade agreements like the FTAA and the educational corporations that benefit from the MCAS and other recent educational reforms.
These companies that are making money off the tests, all right, they're moving the grading to, you know, to Tampa, Florida, or New Jersey, but they still got to pay minimum wage. They could have the test graded in India or Pakistan. Well, they only have to pay $1 an hour, right, or 50 cents an hour, right? So the same factors driving manufacturers abroad to get sweatshop labor is operating in the service sector. Now, do you know that the initial WTO conditions didn't cover services? One of the things that was going on in WTO, but it got blocked, is they were trying to get into the WTO open markets for the penetration of these kind of services, educational services, etc., libraries. I don't know who all the players are, and it goes every which way, right? Some of these U.S. companies, there's a big educational market in Brazil. It's not as big as the U.S., but it's big. There's a big one in Argentina. There's a big one in Europe, right? They want to privatize public schools, not just in the United States, but in these other places. And also they want to be able to move around the labor costs and things like that. And in the FTAA negotiations, in there is a little piece of language that very clearly allows for these educational services to be covered by the free trade, but again, not the teachers' unions. You won't be able to, right? You won't be able to get access to unionize the workforce, but you won't be able to stop them from moving the work back and forth.
There was a lively discussion following King's talk. One audience member who works at an elementary school in Mattapan drew further connections between the MCAS and corporate globalization.
And I just want to put another link in this chain here of we're talking about privatization of public services. What's, well, perhaps not in numbers, but in intent, the largest growing sector of the U.S. economy, the prison sector. When you have uneducated people that can't get good jobs or are forced to work at jobs that they hate, it's very easy for them to be funneled, or if they are especially in need because of whatever reason, it's very easy for them to get funneled, flunking out of school through maybe a really low-paying job straight into the prison cell, where not only is that making money for a large company that has privatized the prison, it also makes money for these corporations that are now contracting prison labor. And a really good place to check out for that is an organization or a kind of a national movement against this called Critical Resistance. And I believe their website is just criticalresistance.org. And I also want to link this back to the kind of global context of, you alluded to this a little bit, John, but some of the exact terms for some of these things. We talk a lot about structural adjustment in other countries, which means, say, in Central America, where I've lived for some time, public services are cut down in order to save money to pay off the foreign debt, these kind of things. It's opened up so corporations can more easily come. That's also happening in this country. We tend to think of it as somewhere else, but that's also happening, and that's the term we use for this kind of thing. And you referred to the WTO just also to put another hopeful note on this, because it can seem like, it's everywhere. At the WTO meetings in Seattle 2 years ago, one of the agreements that was being negotiated was the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, which was to cover services, trade and services. That was defeated or not enacted, largely in part to massive popular protests. Unfortunately, that's now largely included in the free trade area of the Americas, the FTAA.
There is a growing movement against the MCAS involving students, teachers, and parents across the state. For more information, contact the Massachusetts Coalition for Authentic Reform in Education at 617-864-4810 or visit their website at www.caremass.org. This is Chris Sturr.
Canadians are facing the same threats to their education system from the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA. To understand the goals of the corporate sector with respect to education, they turn to their counterparts in Mexico. Next, a report from a documentary series on the FTAA produced at CKLN Radio in Toronto.
Welcome to the Free Thought Area of the Airwaves. This series of radio documentaries covers issues related to the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, produced at CKLN-FM Radio in Toronto, Canada, with support from the Center for Social Justice, Canadian Auto Workers, and the Ryerson Students Administrative Council.
My name is Susie Alvarez, and this segment is dedicated to the upcoming Free Trade Area of the Americas Agreement and its impact on education. Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that everyone has the right to education. Education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect and fundamental freedoms. Most important, as put in Article 28, that everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. For this piece, we spoke to Erin George of the Canadian Federation of Students, a student-directed association which is mobilizing thousands of Canadian students to protest in Quebec City. We also spoke to Rémi Bourget of the student association, the Cégep de Vieux-Montréal, part of the large militant student movement in Quebec. A Cégep is a post-secondary school that provides professional training and academic preparation for university. Also collaborating in this piece is Oscar Carrillo Arroyo from the General Strike Council of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. The General Strike Council was responsible for coordinating a 10-month strike in 1999 at a campus of 250,000 students. The decision to strike was prompted by proposed increases to the admission fees and in protest against plans to privatize post-secondary education in Mexico.
If the Free Trade Area of the Americas is signed, the very fundamental things that make our education system public, accessible, quality will be jeopardized. Under the Free Trade Area of the Americas, public funding for public universities and colleges in the form of operating grants, research funding, student financial assistance like scholarships, loans, and bursaries, that is considered an unfair subsidy. A private university or college could argue to the dispute court of the Free Trade Area of the Americas that public universities and colleges have an unfair competitive advantage because of unfair subsidies, or what we would call public funding. And they would have a right to sue our government for lost profits and to cease the practice of public funding, or to make public funding equally available to both public and private. So it's quite disturbing that our public dollars could be taken away from our public system or would have to be distributed equally between a public system where the right to education is paramount versus a private system where reaping profits is of paramount importance.
The terms of a finalized and implemented trade agreement that includes services and subsidies as its primary issues may result in pressure directed towards weaker economies, which may end up opening up their education sector to private foreign investment in order to gain access to outside markets. One clear and blunt example is Chile, where the World Bank forced the government to privatize a large portion of its post-secondary education system. Mexico has also suffered the pressure to deregulate its education system.
The plan to privatize universities in Mexico is part of the global neoliberal plan to privatize social services such as education. In Mexico, this process began about 15 years ago, just around the time when neoliberal policies began to spread. This plan aims to create elitist universities where only a very small percentage of the population will attend. Today, only 6% of the population attends universities. And of these 6%, 95% come from the middle to upper classes. So that's very few people from the barrios or marginalized communities and working classes that attend universities. So the strike began because the administration wanted to increase the admission fees. Unfortunately, like many other movements, we began ours with a direct response to the agenda, first fighting for our own interests, but also with a reaction against the authoritarian-like changes. That were in step with the demands placed by the IMF and the World Bank. The government does not care about the impact of these reforms. They have already signed the treaties and sold the national resources and the national autonomy, including the universities. 12 board members control the universities. 80% of the university's budget is used to support this bureaucracy, and corruption is full-fledged. The administration counts with two former government secretaries, one of which was in office during the massacre in Chiapas. These two form part of the Institute of Legal Research. We have many more of these mafias within the university, and these are the ones that are controlling the campus and the ones who sold it.
Everything started when X-Squirty just got the Transfert Social Canadien to transfer payments because the province didn't have enough money to continue. So after it, there was in Quebec in 96 another summit. That summit gave the government the mandate to arrive at deficit zero. And deficit zero, what does it mean? It means cuts in healthcare, cuts in education, cuts everywhere to arrive at the zero deficit. From that moment, the big cuts arrived, and then, of course, the college and the university, to get the money, they just tried some deal with the private companies or big corporation, and they sell the student for money. Wherever you look, you see a big, big, big fridge of Coca-Cola. It's an advertisement. And you look in your agenda, so you've got all the little page from Coca-Cola. So you see Coca-Cola everywhere in the Cégep. And that money should not come from big corporation. They should just pay their due to the state that would put this in education. Because if you look, most of the time they pass by what they call a foundation, comme de charité. No? So the company which give money to a foundation doesn't pay taxes to government. It's them that are just the winner in this. It's the big corporation, it's not the student. We fought a lot against Coca-Cola. We had a referendum and 71% of people voted against Coca-Cola. But the Cégep just doesn't recognize it. We can't even see what's in the deal because it's signed with the foundation of the Cégep, which is a corporation that is independent of the Cégep itself. So it's all fucked up.
Tuition fees have risen in the past years at a very rapid pace. leaving university campuses filled with mostly middle to upper class students who can afford to pay for administrative fees, services, and books. The education systems of many of the Latin American and Caribbean countries that will be present in Quebec will be under great attack, leaving populations of millions and millions of working class, marginalized, and poverty-stricken men, women, and children vulnerable and at the mercy of market forces that have no interest in having them obtain an education. They prefer to have them remain ignorant and illiterate and ready to take their positions at the Maquila-style assembly line.
Changes to the university system began at the bachillerato level, which is the pre-university year. The change was first through the modification of the programs of study and the reduction of the admissions quota known as la matrícula to all years, including the pre-university level. Also, about 5 to 6 years ago, a filtering exam was implemented which aims to encourage the attendance of upper-class students. Just so you can see how absurd this exam really is, it is not really about knowledge, but a social-economic study. Students are asked how many times a week they eat eggs, steak, etc. Moreover, it is an exam of reactivos, a set of questions like ones posed in factory tests that have little to do with knowledge, but more with background. The Mexican system of education has been completely abandoned. At the national level, the average person only finishes fifth grade of primary school. The great majority is illiterate, or functionally illiterate, for they know how to read and write, yet only 3% of the Mexican people has a habit of reading. The newspaper that has the biggest circulation in the country only prints close to 16,000 copies per day. The poor reading habits that we see in Mexico is a direct result of the poor education that they promote.
The Canadian education system will suffer greatly if the FTAA comes to pass. Not only post-secondary education will be limited to those who can afford to pay high fees and tuitions, primary and secondary students are also facing a grim future, where what was once considered a basic human right will be quickly turned into a commodity that will be sold at prices determined by market forces.
For a student, it means for all my high school, you know, you work with the old book because there's no money to buy some new. You're in a class with 40, 41 people. Then you arrive at Cégep and it's the same thing. You work sometimes on old stuff, old computer, and it's slow. It always it bug. We see in the services to student, there's a lack. You know, you can see that, okay, you would like to meet a psychologist. Okay, you come next week. You come the Tuesday afternoon after 1:30. If it's not possible, 2 weeks later, they'll have something for you. You know, you arrive at in the Cégep and you quit your little town. You arrive in big city or big school, but you don't have anything just to help you in this. And so that's why people there often they fail one or two courses, and then there's the failure tax to people that can pass the course. So you see the failure tax arrived because of the cuts in education too. It's a way to like rationalize, I don't know if it's a good word, the poor student, the student that are not as good as the other one. They quit the educational system, because if you have $300 or $400 to pay before you can go back to school, there's a lot of chances that you won't come back to school.
With neoliberalism, we begin to see legal charges placed on services such as computer laboratory fees, student IDs, and also course fees that charge extraordinary amounts to students, leaving only a few able to enroll. Thus, what has happened in the past years is that the administrative authorities have been able to change the social makeup of the university. But for students of low-income families, it became difficult to attend university. given that what it costs to buy a book may at times feed an entire family for a week. The libraries in Mexico lack resources. For example, the library of my faculty, Philosophy and Literature. It should be one of the largest collections, and capacity is one of the smallest. It holds close to 100 students when the faculty counts with about 8,000 students.
The students have been fighting against these attacks and struggling to defend the right to education on our campuses, with the provincial government and with the federal government. But we also have to take this struggle for the right to education to a global scale, because there's no point in fighting at a board of governors or with our different levels of government if our governments are signing international trade agreements that usurp the democratic decision-making at those three levels and are paramount. So we need to be fighting for the right to education on all different fronts.
Part of our proposal was to have a university that was more linked to the community and more accessible for everyone. Why should there be a few who can take advantage of this and the rest who are left without a right to information, which should be everyone's right? If the university cannot provide everyone this right, then there is something wrong with the university.
This program was produced as part of the Free Thought Area of the Airwaves series, with research, recording, and production by
Kristen Schwartz,
Christiana Clemens,
Antonia Baker,
Greg Duffel,
Susie Alvarez,
Mona Gupta,
Bernie Munich,
and Kathy Cumberland.
Music by Miss KLC and Jackson Two Bears, produced with support from the Center for Social Justice, Canadian Auto Workers, and the Ryerson Students Administrative Council.
You can shoot me with your cannons, you can get me with a horse, maybe make your dogs to bite me or gas me in my face. Beat me with your implements, your weapons of your war, but you'll never stop the mob we make, cause I bring 50 more. A pueblo unido jamás será vencido. A pueblo unido jamás será vencido. A pueblo unido jamás será vencido. You can shoot me at point blank, you can drop me from afar, you can jail me and all my friends on $1 billion bail. You can silence the resistor, but you'll never get us all, cause your actions radicalize your very family. Here's a call. A pueblo unido jamás será vencido. A pueblo unido jamás será vencido. A pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
That was Pueblo by Marco Capelli. At the end of last month, opponents of the biotechnology industry staged a counter-convention at a national gathering of biotech industry representatives in San Diego, California. Family farmers from the U.S. and Canada were among the protesters. In a panel that was part of the educational component of the protest, they spoke about how ag biotech is destroying their livelihoods, the food supply, and on the ripple effect of government agricultural policy on the society in general. Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio was at the conference and provided us with this tape.
For those of you who are not aware, FarmAid is an organization, a nonprofit organization that works nationwide in the U.S. and strives to keep family farmers on their land doing what family farmers do best, which is producing fresh and healthful food for all of us. Our challenge today is to discuss issues and concerns that family farmers have raised about genetic engineering. We refer to, in general, genetic engineering as GMOs. We talk a lot about GMOs or Roundup Ready this or Roundup Ready that and BT this and BT that. We're talking about biotechnology applied to farming. What we're going to talk about is issues and concerns that family farmers have about this new technology. They're questioning GMOs, and they're challenging corporate and political power that seems determined to put these GMOs on our plates, whether we want them there or not. Just to clarify a little bit, what some family farmers are facing when we talk about this new technology applied to farming. I'm going to tell the story of a North Dakota soybean farmer who was raising what he thought were non-GMO soybeans, He had a contract with a Japanese buyer who believed that he was going to be buying non-GMO soybeans, and because they were non-GMO, he was willing to pay a premium price for those soybeans. Well, after the harvest, the soybeans were tested, and there was GMO contamination, apparently caused by pollen drift from a neighboring field. The buyer rejected the beans, and the farmer lost $6,000 in a price premium on his crop. But the issue of pollen drift and genetic contamination is just one of dozens of issues facing family farmers today in this biotech era. The economic and potential human health impacts of GMOs is another issue that we are having to deal with. You've heard, I suspect, about Starlink corn. Among other things, health issues that are being raised about this type of corn, it's a huge economic disaster for family farmers. It's really the latest GMO disaster. It's not the first. John Kinsman, a lifelong Wisconsin dairy farmer and vice president of the National Family Farm Coalition, is here to remind us that GMO concerns go back at least 15 years, at least in the food arena. That's when Monsanto began trying to sell what's called recombinant bovine growth hormone, RBGH, to dairymen around the country. RBGH is a genetically modified product. It's intended to increase milk production on dairy farms. And John will tell us about his fight against RBGH and report on some corporate deception used to promote GMOs. Now, along with pollen drift and contamination, farmers are finding it harder to find non-GMO seed stock. There is pollen drift contaminating the seed stock in the country, and it seems like everywhere farmers look these days, given the acreages that are being dedicated to growing GMOs, that everywhere farmers look, there are GMOs in the air, in the pollen, and in the marketplace. Bill Christensen, who happens to be a soybean and corn grower from Missouri and is also the president of the National Family Farm Coalition, will tell us about some of these seed difficulties and also talk with us about the difficulties that farmers are facing as they try to raise non-GMO soybeans, corn, and other commodities in a world where there is so much contamination and so many soybean crops are out there that are GMO. So it's a question of how you keep those non-GMO and GMO crops separate. It's called, in the industry, segregation, and I suspect that Bill is going to tell you that segregation doesn't work. There's also questions that farmers are raising about patents. Now, multinational corporations, the guys that are giving us Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup Ready corn, patent those seeds. The farmers we work with almost universally oppose the idea that you can patent life in any form. But without those patents, there really isn't any profit for corporations to get into the kind of thing that they're doing now. And so what they've decided to do is challenge family farmers, drag them into court, and sue them for doing what they've done for thousands of years, which is to save seed. Monsanto is particularly adept at bringing family farmers into the courtroom. Percy Schmeiser, a lifelong canola grower from Saskatchewan, Canada, finds himself the target of a troubling lawsuit by Monsanto. And we're fortunate to have Percy here with us today to share his story of what's clearly a miscarriage of justice when the courts in Canada found him responsible for saving seed from a field contaminated with GMOs from a neighbor's crop. Really, when you look at what's happening with family farmers, it seems like there's no end to the horror stories about GMOs and what their impact is in farm country. But there is a light. Farmers are organizing. They're challenging the corporate power structure, and Bill Wenzel, the national director of the Farmer to Farmer campaign and an attorney with a long history of fighting for clean water and opposing factory farm food production, will be here to shed some light on the organizing that's going on. He'll also talk about market issues, helping to awaken family farmers, and there are many of them who really aren't with it in terms of just how dangerous and damaging GMO production can be, awakening those farmers to the problems and the threat that they face.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. We continue with our panel on family farmers and biotechnology.